and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the Valparaiso City Attorney, Patrick Lipp, being named to the Board of the Regional Development Authority. Brenda Smith reports on the creation of the Rental Assistance Program designed to help Hoosiers affected by the coronavirus pandemic. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Edgewater Health President and CEO, Dr. Danita Johnson Hughes. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Valparaiso City Attorney and former Economic Development Director Patrick Lipp has been named to the Board of the Regional Development Authority. He was named to the board by Governor Eric Holcomb. Since it was established in 2005, the RDA has been the catalyst for numerous regional projects, including the completed runway expansion at Gary Chicago International Airport and the enhancement of the regional Lake Michigan shoreline. Currently, the RDA, in partnership with NCDE and state government, is at the forefront of two transformative commuter rail projects, Double Tracking and Westlake Corridor, and the complementary transit-oriented developments. Lipp has been a speaker on the subject of legal ethics and is a recipient of the Friends of Mental Health Association Award. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Thousands of Hoosier renters facing eviction in the coming weeks might get a little help from the state. Officials announced the creation of a rental assistance program Wednesday. It will provide $500 a month for 4 months to people who've lost income during the pandemic. Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority Director Jason Sipe notes that won't cover full rent.
In Indiana, the median rent is $825. So it's important that the household continue to work with their landlords to make a payment plan to make those payments.
Landlords have to agree to participate in the program for Hoosiers to get help. When asked what people should do if their landlords won't participate, Sipe only urged renters to talk with their landlords. Governor Eric Holcomb did announce he's extending the ban on evictions through the end of July. The program is available for Hoosiers in 91 of 92 counties. Marion County has its own program. People can begin to apply July 13th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana housing authorities say the state's new rental assistance program set up the pipeline to help Hoosiers in need, but it still needs to be filled with resources. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenton Smith reports the state says its effort will help 12,000 households pay rent.
The Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition estimates the new program would still leave around 200,000 households without help. But the coalition's Andrew Bradley says the program is a good start, and its early results should help guide the state moving forward.
Have we provided enough resources, and have we targeted those resources to the families who need them the most?
The program requires landlords to participate in order for Hoosiers to get assistance. Bradley says that's not a bad thing.
It at least provides an opportunity for landlords and tenants to work together. And this is how it's written into the plan, to create a payment plan so that they're both on the same page.
Bradley says landlords who don't participate would likely have a tougher time in court trying to evict their tenants. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb says Indiana's public schools can apply for funding to improve their remote learning capabilities during the coronavirus pandemic through a $61.6 million grant program. Holcomb announced Monday that the deadline is July 17th to apply for the needs-based competitive funding through the governor's Emergency Education Relief, which is financed by the Federal CARES Act. Traditional public schools school corporations, public charter schools, accredited non-public schools, higher education institutions, and other education-related entities are eligible to apply for the grants. The state expects to award dozens of grants through the program.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Schools have finally received guidance from the state on reopening for next school year, though the guidance is loose and not mandatory. The Indiana Department of Education released broad school reentry guidelines on June 5th, but State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick said local leaders must decide how their schools will operate themselves. Per Governor Eric Holcomb's order, Indiana schools are allowed to reopen July 1st. The Indiana Department of Education recommends schools use their reentry document, Indiana's Considerations for Learning and Safe Schools, as a guide, but they go on to suggest consulting the local health department to determine their own plans. The Post Tribune reports some of the guidance told schools to look to the Centers for Disease Control guidelines for things such as mask wearing, as well as the physical distancing of students, but Superintendent Larry Verasco says that doesn't help districts with large school populations like the Lake Central School Corporation. Some, such as the four Indiana House Democrats serving on the Indiana Committee, expressed their disappointment for the guidelines. The four Democrats called for stronger leadership from Holcomb in a letter sent to him in early June. According to the Indianapolis Star, Holcomb said there will not be a one-size-fits-all approach for reopening, though he's convinced all the schools will be able to reopen safely in late June and early August. The Indiana Department of Education will continue to update its COVID-19 resources for Indiana schools page as the situation evolves.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Flooding devastated homes and farms in Indiana last year. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the ongoing effects of the pandemic could strain Indiana's ability to respond to disasters like floods, tornadoes, or extreme heat.
Nicolette Louis-Saint is the executive director of Healthcare Ready, a national nonprofit that coordinates healthcare supply chains. She says, just like the 2017 hurricane season, every federal disaster agency is responding to the current crisis. But with COVID-19, so are local and state agencies, and they often don't have as many resources.
They're going into budgets that should be prepared for natural disasters already. And so they are already stretched in ways, both financially and from a personnel perspective.
Louis-Saint says there may also be fewer emergency contractors and volunteers available for fear of catching COVID-19. That could be an issue in places that don't have good internet access. An official with the American Red Cross says the organization has adjusted its response plan should disaster strike in Indiana alongside the pandemic. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana universities will not be able to bring many skilled international professors and researchers to the state until 2021. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports that's due to an executive order from President Trump designed to protect American jobs.
The order says during a time of high unemployment, skilled foreign workers with H-1B visas pose, quote, an unusual threat to the employment of American workers. Indiana colleges like Purdue and Indiana University employ hundreds of professors under the program, as well as researchers. Hannah Buxbaum, Vice President of International Affairs at IU, says it currently has about 350 employees with H-1B visas. She says universities and industry both rely on the ability to recruit skilled international workers to strengthen the economy.
For the long-term success of American companies, you know, it is absolutely critical that we be able to attract the best researchers.
Buxbaum added that the order is prohibiting around 20 current and prospective employees who are out of the country from entering. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Dr. Donita Johnson-Hughes.
This is regionally speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dr. Donita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health here in Northwest Indiana, and she has written an interesting guest column that was published just recently in the Post Tribune that deals with the three major issues that we are taking a look at here in the region in particular: pandemic, the police, and politics. And she is with us to talk about these topics, and thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your thoughts in penning this particular guest column?
Well, Chris, I believe, you know, I thought about it because it just seems like our world is in such flux right now that we have all of these competing things going on, and in a sense, they're so very much related, particularly the issue with the pandemic, the coronavirus that's impacting our nation in a way that I can never even remember that we've been affected by it before. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when there is such a pandemic or when there is a public health emergency, typically people of color suffer a bit more. They contract the disease at higher rates than others, and they die at higher rates than others. So in proportion to the general population, they're impacted in a much more devastating way. And then we've got the issues going on with the police, and again, another public health emergency. It has been, you know, our country suffers from an illness already, and that illness is racism. Mm-hmm. We've never gotten beyond that. It is a public health crisis. So we've got all of these things going on at one time, and in order to resolve them, it's going to take a concerted effort by everyone to make sure that we can eradicate our community of racism. It's a systemic problem. It's been going on forever, and it impacts the health and well-being of all of us, but particularly those populations of color.
Let's take each topic and break it out in more detail here. Let's begin first with the pandemic and your thoughts that you've got together in putting it together in this way: the pandemic, the police, and politics. Let's do the pandemic first.
Okay, the pandemic. The fact is that, again, because of the raging health disparities that Black people are confronted with that are a result of a number of social issues that impact them, such as poverty, poor education, economic systems, you know, all of these things converge to put African Americans, and that's what I'm talking about mostly in this particular segment, put them in a position of not being able to adequately relieve themselves of the emotional and psychological distress of having these experiences every day, of living in a system where they're consistently confronted with adverse conditions, housing, homeless, you know, the homelessness issue, food deserts where they don't have enough food or they're not able to feed their families and provide housing for them. They're not able to access health care as much as others simply because of transportation issues or economic issues. And plus, a lot of people are distrustful of physicians, and they've been for years. They're just distrustful, and so they don't believe that they can trust their practitioners. So there are a number of things that really impact the way that Black people access care. And their systems are poorly funded, they don't get adequate health care, and it's all attributable to what I believe is systemic racism. Mm-hmm. It contributes to the marginalization of people of color. As a result, they experience psychological distress, and that impacts their entire well-being. If you don't have good mental health, good physical health, and good social health, you don't have good health. So all of those things come together to create a wholesome, healthy individual and community.
And let's take up the second point that's in your guest column, the police.
Okay, when it comes to the police, I think it's really important, and a lot of people you know, some people may already know this and some people may not. But you have to think about how the whole police state came to being in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And how it came to being was that back in the 1700s, early 1700s, when there was slavery, they had these patrols, these slave patrols that were actually designated to go out, capture, apprehend runaway slaves. One of their objectives was also to deter revolt, so that the slaves would not revolt on the plantation, and they were created to create intimidation, fear amongst slaves, so that they wouldn't run away, so that they wouldn't revolt. And so I think that a lot of those attitudes have carried over into what has evolved into today's system of policing. It's the mentality of it, the whole idea of its construction. It has all come together to create a situation where, first of all, black people are not valued. Secondly, whether we believe it or feel it or are conscious about it or not, it's also a way to keep black people in their place. The overrepresentation of them in prison, which is 5 times the rate of the general population, they're killed 3 times more than others by police officers. And so all of this stuff has come together to create what I consider to be a public health crisis today.
And I also note that you mentioned in that particular segment on talking about the police that it isn't just, a problem of biased police officers. It goes beyond that.
It's not just biased police officers. It's a general, devaluation and marginalization of people of color. And I give the example in the article of the issue that's all front and center today, with Ahmaud Arbery being hunted down, you know, just like an animal, and killed by white people who just felt that his life was of no value. He's out jogging, you know, and he's just hunted down and killed for sport. That's an issue. And then I think about our children who, they grow up fearful of the police. When I was in school, I remember us having visits by the police officers and others, and they were considered officer friendly. Mm-hmm. But things have just sort of gone in a direction that really is just not healthy for our country. Ahmaud Arbery is not a police situation, but there are so many other situations that are not really directly related to the police. But it's not just the killing of people of color, of black people. It's just the opportunities that they're not allowed to take advantage of, like good educational systems, well-funded educational systems, like access to health care, especially in urban areas. Just so many things that they're not able to take advantage of because the system is designed to keep people from moving up, to move outside of those margins, that marginalization. So it's not just police officers. It's just a system of racism that has really harmed our country. I think a part of it is, I really do believe that we have all these, you've heard of them, where we have these trainings to create cultural awareness and cultural diversity and to help people to understand how to work with different groups, different professions, how to work with different groups. But I think what we need to do is a deeper dive. Mm-hmm. I think that what we really need to do is we need to go back and really analyze and evaluate how was this country founded and how in those days did certain people become marginalized, such as Native Americans, and then later on, people who were captured and who actually provided the capital on which this country was built, black people, Africans. So, you know, I think people need to really look at the history, things like when they were protesting and talking about the president doing that rally in Fed rally recently, where he didn't really think about the date of it, which was Juneteenth. And in Oklahoma, he didn't really understand and didn't even understand what they talked about when they talked about where it was located near Black Wall Street. They didn't talk about that. And so those things are important in order to understand, you know. And to me, those are the kinds of things that when you look at them, here's a very prominent Black community in the 20s, and it was not allowed to continue because of racism.
We're talking with Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes. She's the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. She's written a recent guest column that's been published in the Post-Tribune. The title of the column is The Pandemic, the Police, and Politics. And let's hear your views about politics now on that.
I really do believe that our country overall is unwell. Mm-hmm. As I've said in the article, I believe our democracy has failed us. This daily system of racial bias and injustice have impacted the physical, emotional, mental well-being of Black people in our country. And I give the example of the alcoholic uncle who's in denial about his addiction. Until he can come to grips with that addiction and take responsibility for the fact that he does have an ailment, and that if he doesn't take responsibility for it and acknowledge it and acknowledge the pain and hurt that it has caused, it'll never get resolved. We have to think about, you know, where we are in our country today and what we can do to move beyond this. And we can move beyond this. It's just that we have to get people on the same page. And I think, as I mentioned, getting them on the same page means creating an understanding of where this all came from. It didn't just pop up because people have, they're just born with these attitudes, because they're not. This is a system of oppression that has occurred since the beginning of our country. And we need to look at how we begin to talk about not just being not a racist, but how we eliminate racism from all of our systems, from all of our institutions, and from our policy making and the decisions around that, so that everyone can have a fair opportunity to succeed. They have the same or economic opportunities, that we eradicate poverty. Because I think about all this money that we were able to come up with because of the pandemic in terms of the CARES program. Just think, if we could take that amount of money and put it towards eradicating poverty, creating better educational opportunities for our students, K through 12 and beyond, if we could take that amount of money and put it into rebuilding our country so that we can eliminate it, racism in our systems. We need to eradicate racism and racial injustice at the same time, and it can be done if we all have a like mind and if that's what we want to do.
It's interesting this should all come about, and this guest column come about at the time when Lakeshore Public Media is once again conducting another race and justice live conversation, talking about the subject here in particular in Northwest Indiana. And have you gotten any reaction to the column from anybody you've talked to since it came out in the Post Tribune?
Yes, I have. A couple of people, actually, and thanking me for writing it. And it was, you know, Black and white who thanked me for writing the column. And just wondering, though, how people will take it. Because, you know, I say that there are in the article, I say that there are things that white people cannot even imagine. They think they understand, but these are things that they haven't experienced and can't imagine, like your children being afraid of police officers. They've not experienced that. So, you know, It's hard to understand those kinds of things when it hasn't happened to you, or having to give that talk to your kids, and not just your sons these days, but your daughters as well. You know, how to react if you're ever stopped by a police officer, because they approach all of these encounters with trepidation. Mm-hmm. They are fearful, and so you have to tell them how to respond if they're ever stopped. You have, and they have to learn, you know, whether people believe it or not, being Black in America it fills you with a tension, anxiety, stress that most people, white people, don't experience. They don't have to think about these things when they wake up, but Black people do on a daily basis. They have to think about these things.
Well, it sounds like this is a reason why Edgewater Health is out there, as along with other organizations, is to help people that are having problems coping with things. And I'm sure it's going to be an ongoing conversation, to be sure, besides just one that happens for the moment. And we thank you very much for spending some time to talk about this and going over your guest column with us today.
All right. Well, I appreciate you. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.